This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The new Quinnipiac poll that came out last week contained at least one finding that might be considered surprising. It found only 3% of Connecticut primary voters rate the issue of guns as the top issue driving their votes during this primary season. Now, this hasn't stopped Hillary Clinton from using this issue during her campaigning in the state to differentiate herself from Bernie Sanders, her chief rival. Today, Where We Live, we'll be talking about this and also about two pieces of legislation at the state capitol in Hartford that could change gun laws in Connecticut. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/Where We Live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Patrick Scahill. He's WNPR's reporter who's been covering guns in the primary campaign for the last couple of days. He's got a story coming up this afternoon on NPR's All Things Considered about this issue. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hi, John.
So first of all, let's start maybe at the beginning here. And one of the more controversial pieces about this, Hillary Clinton is trying to, as I said, differentiate herself from Bernie Sanders in various ways. One of them has to do with their stances on guns and gun control. Hillary Clinton has, in a number of ways, appropriated some of the individuals who are involved around the Sandy Hook school shooting. Before we talk, let's have an excerpt from a commercial that is for Hillary Clinton. It features Dawn Hochsprung's daughter, Erica Smigelski.
No one is fighting harder to reform our gun laws than Hillary. She reminds me of my mother. She isn't scared of anything. And that's how I know that she is the person that can actually make a difference. That's why I believe in her. That's why millions of other Americans believe in her. There's finally someone who can change things.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
Again, that's a Hillary Clinton ad featuring Erica Smigelski. Remind us who Dawn Hochsprung is, Patrick.
So she was the principal of the Sandy Hook Elementary School, and she died during the 2012 shooting, along with 25 other people.
So as you've been covering this the last couple of days, obviously this issue has come up time and time again. We're going to be talking about this Quinnipiac poll in just a couple of minutes. But I know that there's been some pushback on kind of both sides of this issue surrounding whether or not it's the right thing to do to be talking about Sandy Hook during the presidential primary.
Right. So we should say, too, this was a fairly large ad buy. Clinton's campaign described it as a six-figure ad buy for an ad that's running over the course of just a few days here in the state. It has been sort of an issue that some folks have pushed back on as Clinton has campaigned here in Connecticut. Erica Smigelski was actually with Hillary last week when she made an appearance in Hartford, along with other folks who were victims of family members of victims of gun violence at Sandy Hook and throughout the state.
So maybe we can put a little finer point on what exactly the differences are between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on this issue. Of course, as we've heard a number of times from Senator Sanders, he comes from a state, Vermont, in which many people own guns. A lot of people use guns for hunting and obviously for personal protection in Vermont. It's a slightly different thing than what you might find in New York State, where Hillary Clinton's from. And it's slightly different than what many other Democrats have been talking about on the campaign trail. What's another way that maybe people can understand what the differences are between these two candidates on this issue?
Well, I mean, I think the one time, so I was at the rally last Thursday that was in Hartford. Again, they were talking about gun violence, and it wasn't really a rally. It was more of a panel discussion on this issue. Bernie was not brought up at all, except for probably about 5 seconds when Hillary mentioned his vote when he was in Congress for the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. And this is a law that is complicated, but the boilerplate explanation of it is it will shield, in most cases, manufacturers and dealers of guns from liability in cases where their products are used in bad ways.
And this has come up a few different times in the campaign trail, including at this debate in Flint, Michigan, back on March 6th. Let's listen to a little bit of the back and forth between the candidates. And here's Anderson Cooper from CNN asking a question.
Right now, families of Sandy Hook victims announced that they are going to sue Remington, which made the AR-15, which was used in the Newtown massacre. Now, they believe, those families believe that Remington, the distributors, the sellers, should be held legally responsible for how that gun, how their product is used. Now, the lawsuit may not go anywhere because of the bill you voted for, legislation that prevents gun makers from being sued. Tonight, what do you say to those families?
Well, this is what I say. If I understand that, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you go to a gun store and you legally purchase a gun. And then 3 days later, you go out and you start killing people. Is the point of this lawsuit to hold the gun shop owner or the manufacturer of that gun liable? If that is the point, I have to tell you, I disagree. I disagree because you hold people, in terms of this liability thing, where you hold manufacturers' liability is if they understand that they're selling guns into an area that is getting into the hands of criminals, of course they should be held liable. But if they are selling a product to a person who buys it legally, what you're really talking about is ending gun manufacturing in America. I don't agree with that.
And again, that's Bernie Sanders talking at a debate in Flint, Michigan, back on March 6th on CNN with Anderson Cooper asking the question. John Dankosky here on Where We Live with Patrick Scahill. So you said that in the event that Hillary Clinton held last week, this is something that was brought up. Hillary Clinton has made some issue of this discrepancy between the two of them. What were some of the people on the panel, including those who were involved as Sandy Hook families, what do they have to say?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that is worth mentioning when it comes to this whole topic, particularly the AR-15, which was the weapon that was used by Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook. So there is a lawsuit that's being posed or put against Remington, which is the parent company of Bushmaster, which made the AR-15, by the Sandy Hook families here in the state. And I think it was just last week, a Connecticut state judge set a date of April 2018 for that lawsuit to go forward. So it kind of, again, highlighted this issue in the political consciousness here in the state. There's been, a little bit of an issue about sort of the impetus behind the lawsuit. And Mark Barden and Jackie Barden actually wrote last week in a Washington Post op-ed that they're not suggesting that Remington should be held liable simply for manufacturing the AR-15. They're actually saying that it's more how the weapon was marketed, and that's the reason why. Basically, saying this is a military grade weapon that you as a sportsman should have to use, and it was more the marketing of it rather than just the manufacturing of it that was sort of the reason for this lawsuit.
And it wouldn't be the first time in American history that the marketing of a product would actually be held against a company. I mean, we think about the huge settlements against cigarette companies. The marketing of cigarettes was what led to the massive settlements that brought so many billions of dollars into state coffers.
Right. So again, the state judge saw that logic, I guess you could say, and this we're not sure how far it's going to go, but it will at least get a hearing in 2018.
Now, one of the Sandy Hook parents who was part of this panel discussion is Nelba Marquez Green. We've heard her voice a number of times on our air before. Here she is talking about this issue at this Hillary Clinton event last week.
So I came today knowing I would be the subject of ridicule and ire, online harassment and abuse, and knowing that people would make mean comments like, oh, there goes Hillary using those Sandy Hook families. And you can ask my husband if anybody can move me or use me for anything, even him, and he will tell you no. So I'm here because it's important.
And here's Hillary Clinton speaking at that same event.
The terrible mass shootings that we know, sadly, all too well, whether it's Sandy Hook or Charleston or the movie theater in Aurora or the community college in Oregon, and there's a very long list, they still represent a minority of the gun violence deaths. Most of those affect young African American and Latino men. In fact, the leading cause of death for young African American men, more than the next nine causes combined, is gun violence.
And of course, Patrick, what that does is it kind of takes us to another part of this issue. If the lawsuit by Sandy Hook families and much of the conversation that came out of the mass shooting at Newtown had to do with assault weapons and magazine capacities and some of those issues, the issue of gun violence in urban areas is something that the candidate wanted to highlight as well. On the panel was Iron Nazario, someone who we've had on the program before, who works for Peace Builders. He's a former gang member, and he's worked to try to stop this very gun violence. Again, guns end up in urban areas like Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven, and that is really what causes so many deaths in America.
Yeah, and this was a point that was emphasized over and over and over again last week at the Hartford event. This was something that Neville Marquez Green said. This was something that Erica Smigelski said. Sandy Hook really is the exception. Obviously, the majority of gun violence does happen in cities and is perpetrated with handguns. So this was a point that Clinton made over and over again. And one number she was throwing around during the event was 33,000 deaths annually come at the hands of gun violence. This is something you can go online to get the whole backstory in this. This number is a little bit debatable. Breitbart has actually reported that it includes deaths by handgun, suicide deaths using a handgun. So there's been a little political pushback on that number itself because she's made it seem like it's murders, this number, but it's more complicated than that. But anyway.
Yeah, and suicides by far are the number one cause of death by handgun in America and have been for quite some time. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Oh, Patrick in Lebanon was there, and now Patrick in Lebanon is not there. So I guess the last thing, Patrick, is this all comes in the context of what Connecticut may be thinking about guns. Obviously, this is a state that has supported gun control legislation in the past. We passed state laws that are stricter than many federal laws. In the wake of Sandy Hook, we already had stricter gun laws on the books. But in the Quinnipiac poll that came out last week, it seems as though it's not a major issue for many Connecticut residents. Here's Doug Schwartz, the director of the Quinnipiac University poll.
Only 3% of likely Democratic primary voters say gun policy is the most important issue to their vote.
So some of the things that did rank higher than gun policy, economy and jobs, that was by far the most important issue to likely Democratic primary voters. Government spending, health care, foreign policy, climate change, income inequality, education, all these issues rated higher.
And it's strange. I mean, we're hearing from a number of national reporters and editors. I'm talking to some later on today. You talked to some last week as you're preparing a piece for NPR. I think around the nation, people are surprised by that. They're surprised that Connecticut, having been, you know, at the center of such horrific gun violence, and we've had to grapple with this for such a long time, that we don't have more people who are seeing guns as a primary issue.
Well, and I think that was honestly a point of frustration that was brought up by several Hartford and New Haven residents at the rally last week. Folks who were saying, who were living in these communities saying, hey, we've been dealing with this issue for decades. It's never been addressed. It gets highlighted in the public consciousness when there is an event like Sandy Hook. The folks at Sandy Hook, obviously, it's a horrible event. They deserve every single piece of aid that they got. But where's the help that we need? Where's the help that we're getting? And that's something that Hillary Clinton said she would try to provide for them if she is elected.
Patrick Scahill, WNPR's reporter, has been covering guns on the campaign trail. He's got a story coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered on NPR. Patrick, it's always good to see you. Thanks so much for being in.
Thanks, John.
When we come back, we're going to take a look at this issue from the standpoint of the state legislature. There are at least two pieces of legislation right now that would change Connecticut's gun laws. We're going to take a closer look at them and whether or not they have chance of passage during this time of great fiscal uncertainty at the Capitol. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In the first segment of the program, we were talking about guns and the Connecticut campaign primary trail. Right now, we're going to take a look at the issue of guns at the state legislature. There's an awful lot going on at the state legislature. Almost all of it has to do with the state budget, but there are a few bills right now that deal with the issue of firearms. First, an act protecting victims of domestic violence. If passed, the law would require anyone who has a restraining order taken out against them to turn over their firearms within 24 hours. Otherwise, they could face felony charges. Joining us today is Steve Stafstrom, who's a Democratic state representative serving Bridgeport. He's a sponsor of this bill. Steve, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Doug Dubitsky is a Republican state representative. He serves towns including Canterbury, Chaplin, Franklin, Hampton, Lebanon. A lot of little towns out there.
Yes, there are.
Yes, there are. Doug, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Steve, first of all, I'd like to ask you about this particular bill. I'm going to be talking through a few, but why don't you tell us about this bill, what exactly it would do, and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Sure. Well, thanks, John. This is actually a bill that came out of the governor's office last year and really started through the process last session and didn't actually make it across the finish line, but did come out of the Judiciary Committee. And what the bill would basically do is when a temporary restraining order is entered against someone following a domestic violence arrest, They would be required to turn over their firearms within 24 hours to law enforcement or to a licensed gun dealer, as you indicated. You know, and we know that within the first 24 hours of any domestic situation really is the most volatile. You know, the situation we're really trying to get at is the situation where someone has, you know, there's been a domestic violence incident in the home. There's been an arrest made. And someone has made a victim, has made an application to the court and said, you know what, I feel that I'm at immediate risk for my domestic partner. That domestic partner has a firearm in the house or otherwise has access to a firearm that they own. And so what we're trying to do is de-escalate that situation by making that firearm be turned over to authorities.
Well, I guess there's a lot to talk about in this. In just a moment, we're going to be bringing in Karen Jarmach from the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Obviously, they've been in support of legislation like this. I will say the governor's office has talked to us and said that they very much support this and are hoping that it gets through the legislature with everything else that's going on. But just to take a look at the practicality of it, and there are a few practical questions. The first is there's a sense that the most important thing that's happening here is that during this really difficult time, a time at which it would matter the most that we might want to get the guns out of the hands of someone who could do violence against another person, that first 24 hours is vital. And what we're talking about, though, is a 24-hour period that the person can have to turn over the guns, essentially setting a ticking clock for the last 24 hours they're allowed to have this firearm. And I guess I'm just wondering how we've thought through the practicalities of that. The fact is that they don't have to hand it over as soon as they're served papers. They have a certain amount of time. And if we're worrying about a kind of a cooling off period or a time in which there may be danger to a partner or a spouse, don't we have a little gap here?
Sure. And I think ideally, yes, you're right that it would be turned over immediately. But I think the fear in crafting legislation sometimes is that you need to craft legislation to encompass every situation. And conceivably, it could be that, a gun is locked in a safe someplace, a gun is in a off-site for storage facility, something of that variety where, you can't turn it over instantaneously. And so we're trying to create a period under which you could access the firearm, get it to your local police department, get it to a licensed gun dealer, and deposit it.
I want to bring into the conversation quickly Karen Jarmach, who's executive director of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Karen, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Could you tell us why you believe that this piece of legislation is important?
Yeah, this is really based on victim safety and through a lot of evidence out in the field where we know that access to a firearm in a domestic violence relationship increases the chance of homicide by 5 times. We know that in Connecticut, through domestic violence homicide, guns are the most prevalent use of force. And we know that on average, 14 people are killed annually in our state due to domestic violence, predominantly with a gun. You mentioned about the gap or the practicality related to the 24 hours. There's things that we can obviously do to protect the victim or the applicant in those circumstances, whether it be shelter or safety planning, to ensure in that 24-hour period that they are safe. And again, this is in the civil court. When someone walks into the civil court, applies for a restraining order, we know that there are 9,000 applications a year, 5,000 on average issued, and less than in 700 circumstances, according to judicial, guns are actually noted or ammunition on the application. So we're talking about in less than 700 circumstances.
Is that shelter or safety planning part of this overall proposal, the notion that there would be some accommodation made for those filing a restraining order?
It's a circumstance that is in alignment and support of this in that out in the field there are advocates working within civil courts in Connecticut whose role it is to assist victims with restraining orders and safety planning. And so it's not in the bill, but it is something that exists foundationally in our state.
I want to bring in Doug Dubitsky to talk about this. Do you broadly support this measure in terms of what it's trying to do? I know that you support an alternative to this. Tell me about, first of all, your thoughts on this particular piece of legislation.
Well, first off, I don't think there's anybody on either side of the aisle at the legislature or anybody in this state who thinks that allowing domestic violence is preferable. Certainly we need to do everything we possibly can. The problem is not only the rhetoric but the solution. Representative Safstrom started out saying that his bill applies only after somebody's been arrested. He said that two times. It's absolutely not true. This bill would apply immediately after somebody applies for a temporary restraining order. That means that somebody walks into a court, fills out an affidavit, and that is it. There's no investigation. There's nothing that determines whether or not those allegations in that affidavit are true. And what this does, if this bill were law, it would disarm a victim where the abuser fills out this form against the victim. So I certainly understand the meaning behind it and the sentiment behind the bill, but it's crafting the wrong solution. The right solution is to use the risk warrant statute, which is already in law. If somebody beats you up and threatens to kill you, you call the police. You don't sue them. And that's the difference between these two bills. And in the bill that Representative Safstrom is pushing has nothing to do with an arrest. If there is an arrest, absolutely. If somebody's arrested for domestic violence, if they have firearms, they should be separated from them. But this bill doesn't involve that. It only involves an ex parte, meaning only one side, application.
Karen Jaromark, did you want to jump in? Go ahead.
In on a few
those
points?
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. Just, we know that this is law in 20 other states and through the civil process. And I understand, Representative Safstrom, it can be confusing. It's sometimes the language is difficult to understand, but this is a civil matter. It's an ex parte. You are correct, Representative Dubitsky. But again, when we're talking about the potential to disarm a victim, we know from an evidence-based risk factors, access to a firearm in a domestic violence relationship increases the chance of homicide by 5 times. It's simply access. It's not talking about who might have that firearm. The danger associated with the presence of a firearm in a domestic violence relationship is huge.
And the thing, just quickly, the thing, Representative Dubitsky, I just want to ask, though, the nature of a restraining order at its heart is that whether or not it has to do with firearms coming out of the home or not, is that essentially this is an application for protection, and there is no, at that point, for any restraining order, ability to prove the allegations. It is not essentially a criminal matter, but a restraining order is used as a tool to protect mostly women and children from an abusive partner. I mean, that's the way it works right now. This is just adding another layer to the way a restraining order has always worked in the law.
It can be, but it can also be turned around. It can be turned around on the victim. We had testimony during the hearings, the public hearings on these bills, from domestic violence victims who have had restraining orders issued against them by their abusers. And you look at a situation. We had testimony from domestic violence abuse victims who supported this bill because they wanted the abusers' firearms taken from them. They very often they didn't understand they didn't know that there was a mechanism under the risk warrant statute to do that. Now you look at a situation. We're looking at specific anecdotes. Well, Carol Brown in New Jersey. New Jersey is one of the very few, it's not 20, it's one of the very few states that have a bill similar to this, a law similar to this bill. And she went for an ex parte restraining order. She got one against her husband who was abusing her. At the same time, she was trying to get a firearm to protect herself against him. And because of New Jersey's arcane firearms law, it took her months and months and months, and she was not able to get her permit. She was not able to protect herself, and her husband came in and stabbed her to death. You can always find situations on both sides where this is not going to work.
But I think what Karen Jarmok's point is that the presence of firearms in a household that has abuse as part of the relationship is the number one risk factor for both sides. The presence of firearms in a volatile situation is one of the leading causes of death in situations like that. And it's kind of a statistical fact, anecdotes aside.
Show me where that fact comes from. You know, that you know, everybody said, everybody claims that's a fact. I have not seen the source data on that. So, you know, I go back to the source data. I go back to the FBI crime, uniform crime statistics. I go to, you know, the you know, all I've heard was this number, five times more likely. Where does that come from?
John, I go back to Dr. Jacqueline Campbell out of Johns Hopkins and the research that she's done for years on this issue, and that's where that five times comes from.
Okay, and I've read her research, and her research is based on the violent, essentially gun control organizations' press releases and things like that. So, you know, statistics can be skewed in any way, but the issue here is whether or not a victim will be disarmed, and in this instance, under this bill, they can be.
Yeah, and we're talking today with Doug Dubitsky, who's a Republican state representative, with Karen Jarmok from the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and Steve Safstrom, Democratic state representative. We're talking about a bill that's in the legislature that deals with domestic violence, a law requiring anyone who has the restraining order taken out against them to turn over firearms within 24 hours. Otherwise, they could face felony charges. We've been talking through this issue. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I think it's fair to say that people can use statistics on all sides of this issue and many other issues to tell various stories. I want to give you a chance to talk, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, John, I just wanted to jump back in real quick on a couple things that were said earlier. And I didn't mean to imply that this would only be used in a situation where there's a criminal arrest. But we know, as Karen said, you know, Representative Dubitsky said earlier that all you have to do is sign the paperwork. Well, it's not just the application. It's also the judge's signature. And I think as Karen made clear earlier, roughly only about half of temporary restraining order applications are actually signed by a judge. And so I think that's an important part, that this isn't just a situation where I walk into the court, I sign a piece of paper, and a restraining order automatically enters. There needs to be the risk of immediate harm found by a judge as verified through the affidavit on that application. And certainly the situation where that would occur most often is where there's been previous instances of physical violence and or an arrest.
So how is this, to the representative's point, how is this different than the risk warrant statute that's on the books now?
It's two separate processes. The risk warrant statute is a separate application process than the TRO process. What this bill attempts to do is to streamline it into one process, where under the existing application process for a temporary restraining order, you check the box that says there's a firearm in the house or firearm owned, and it's one application, one time for the judge to do it, as opposed to a victim who would have to go to court twice in two separate application processes under risk warrant and temporary restraining order.
So go ahead.
Again, that's completely misrepresenting what the bill does. The bill that Representative Safstrom and the governor are pushing do not even mention the risk warrant statute. The risk warrant statute is something that I have introduced, a bill that would do that, that would put the two together, that would say when somebody goes in to apply for a temporary restraining order, that there is information on the risk warrant statute, and if they check the box that say they're in immediate risk of danger, you know, from this person, then it would go to the risk warrant statute. The bill that the governor put forth and that Representative Safstrom is advocating doesn't do that. It doesn't put the two together. That's my bill. My bill does put the two together and says that when you go to get when you file an application for a temporary restraining order, if you are in immediate risk of danger, you get the police involved. You get them involved right away, because if somebody is beating you up and threatens to kill you, you get the police involved. You don't go a civil route and sue them.
Very quickly, would you support his bill?
As I said, I don't think his bill is necessary. I think we already have a risk warrant statute on the books, and this is attempting to beef up our TRO statute.
Karen Jarmok, could you talk through a little bit about what the barriers might be to someone who feels in danger going to the police in the way that the Representative Dubitsky has just said?
Sure, and you know, we've been talking about this from our end of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and the Battered Women's Justice Project issued a policy brief on this, why a risk warrant isn't the sole option for a victim, and there are various reasons why victims do not feel comfortable going to the police, and the civil process of an ex parte order is therefore so vital. You know, sometimes victims have bad experiences with police, historical understandings of what way law enforcement may or may not be helpful to them. They may be afraid that they may be arrested too inadvertently. We know that Connecticut has the highest dual arrest rate in the country at 20%. And so they're fearful often of police, and that is why they have the right to choose the option of the ex parte process. And at the end of the day, if you simply avail yourself of the risk warrant process, you still don't have the protections offered through an ex parte order. That is not to say that for some victims the risk warrant might be an option, but victims need options, and they also need to be informed. And so if it's on an application that says risk warrant, or, you know, victims simply know they want to be safe. They don't understand all these technicalities. And so the concern is that someone could check off a box and inadvertently be pushed into a different form or process without their really full understanding and knowledge.
So from your standpoint in working to protect victims, Karen, would one simple standard way of doing this, essentially saying, I am at risk, and I'm going to check all the boxes and essentially make sure that as much protection as possible is afforded me, that there's one process, not multiple processes. Is that what you're saying?
No, here's the thing, John. When someone's going in to apply for a restraining order, they're often doing it alone, right? And so there's, you know, so they're not fully understanding always of what does it mean when I check off this box or that box. And so to walk in and check off all boxes, no, I think that, you know, there is an ex parte process. It's there for a reason. Victims can also avail themselves, if they choose to, of a risk warrant process. Victims need options. It depends on the circumstance of how they're choosing to safety plan and stay safe.
Okay, I want to get to a phone call here. Gavin is in Hebron now. Hi, Gavin.
How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
So I've been following this debate a little bit, as well as the bill proposed by Representative Stafstrom. My question is for Representative Dubitsky, as far as what I see as inconsistencies in his position. I hope you can clarify it for me. It's a two-part question. I'll be pretty brief about it. The first is the bill that Representative Stafstrom is proposing and supports. It also deprives an accused person of his or her liberty interest, not allowing him back in the House. Liberty is a constitutional right that I think is just as important as Second Amendment rights. So to Representative Dubitsky, why are you specifically focusing on guns? Where is your outrage for the liberty deprivation? And then secondly, due process in the criminal context, ex parte findings are used quite a bit for a judge to find probable cause to sign off on an arrest or search warrant. Why are you not fighting due process and ex parte findings in the criminal context? Well, you know, why are you specifically focusing it on the civil context here?
Gavin, thank you very much for your questions.
Okay. Well, to the second part of your question first, I certainly am concerned about the about ex parte statements being used in criminal context. Sure, but in this instance, with regard to the liberty aspect, the person is the recipient of the TRO is deprived of their firearms, which in this instance would be the only way that a victim would be able to defend herself against the abuser. So if an abuser has a TRO issued against the victim, is told, okay, you can't go back into your house. Okay, she'll go somewhere else. But if she's told that she can't have her firearm to protect herself against the abuser, well, then you have the same situation as Carol Brown in New Jersey, where the abuser can effectively disarm the victim and has the ability now to go in and do what he wants. Now, I'm sorry, what was the first part of your question again?
I'm sorry, here, Gavin, go ahead quickly if you would.
The first part was about how the bill doesn't just focus on Second Amendment deprivation, also focuses on the liberty deprivation. So, an accused person is not allowed back in his house.
Well,
so I'm just curious.
Okay, well, that's not necessarily true. This bill only deals with the firearm aspect. The judge has the discretion to issue whatever order is necessary based on the allegations in the ex parte affidavit. So it isn't always the case where somebody is prevented from going into their house, and the that aspect of the law and that aspect of the court's discretion is not addressed by this bill.
And if I could just real quick, John, the there's a difference, obviously, between what's in current law and what's in the bill. Obviously, current law allows, and as it should, in my opinion, that allow a judge to make a ruling to keep domestic partners aside from apart from each other, where there's accusations of of impropriety in the relationship, or where that's one party or the other feels that's needed. As far as the due process concern, I think, as Karen mentioned a couple times, there's about 20 other states that have similar bills. We can debate about how similar they are or they aren't, but we're not aware of any situation in any of those 20 states where the law has been overturned on constitutional due process grounds. We are aware of Massachusetts, which has a bill fairly similar to the one we're proposing here, where a district court in Massachusetts back in 2000 found that law to withstand constitutional muster. Now, due process, obviously under the Constitution, can be limited in the right circumstances where there's a compelling state interest to do that. There's a four-part test that's spelled out in our case law, and we believe this current bill meets each of those checkboxes to withstand constitutional muster.
I have to ask you a few more practical questions, and I asked you the one about this 24-hour time period. The other is just about the practicality of having someone give up their firearms. I mean, the way a restraining order tends to be filed is by a marshal will come and serve a restraining order. How's that normally served?
Yeah, a state marshal can serve it either in hand or a boat service.
So I mean, a practical question is who's really responsible for getting these guns out of someone's house, for knowing how many guns are there, for knowing that the person is turning over these guns legally, for allowing someone to take his firearms, if he has several of them, put them in the car and drive them to a police station? I mean, how practically does any of this stuff work?
Right. Well, obviously, that's the responsibility of the gun owner that has been charged and has been has had a TRO enter against them to turn that over. There is a notice provision to local police department in the bill, and it would be incumbent upon them to produce the firearms.
Incumbent upon them in what way? What is a local, in some small town in Connecticut, what do the local cops have to do if they find out that somebody has a temporary restraining order against them? The spouse says there's 12 different guns in the house. What are the cops supposed to do?
Like I said, it's incumbent upon them under the bill that they can be charged with a felony conviction for not turning the guns over voluntarily within 24-hour time period.
Okay, and then the local police would then go essentially make an arrest.
They could.
Okay. And are you concerned about the safety at all of any of the people, whether it's the marshal serving an order or police who are showing up at what may be a disgruntled person's house asking for their firearms?
Well, the marshal is not showing up asking for somebody's firearms. The marshal is serving the temporary restraining order one way or the other.
According to this new bill, would mean that they would have to turn over their firearms within 24 hours.
Obviously, we're dealing with a very volatile situation here. I mean, we're dealing with, as Karen said, a situation where, you know, in Connecticut, on average, we have 14 deaths a year by intimate partner homicide following a. So yes, we're very concerned that this is a powder keg. We're trying to de-escalate that. I understand the opponent.
The other piece to this, and I apologize for interrupting, but this is law currently when there's a protective order issued when there's a criminal charge. So this language, the process isn't different, although it's slightly different in that, I apologize, it's a 48-hour time frame or two business days. So, the process is also, it's been working. The other piece that I would say to this is parts of this bill that we don't talk a whole lot about that are really, really important around service of orders and communication between law enforcement and marshals and judicial, and how that is going to be strengthened if this bill passes because of the language that's in there. And so it speaks to a lot of what you're talking about, and so there's supportive information in the bill that will help with that process.
Karen, I just wanted to thank Karen Jarmach as Executive Director of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Karen, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, just very, very quickly. You know, this bill has the best of intentions, obviously, but it's very poorly thought out. There are things that just make no sense. For example, if a person is arrested and convicted of actually beating somebody, actually beating their wife, they will have 2 business days to turn over their firearms, and they could give them to any person in the state who is legally allowed to possess them, or sell them to a firearms dealer, or give them to the police. In this instance, simply on an unverified ex parte allegation, they're required to relinquish them within 24 hours, not 2 business days, and they can only give them to the police or to an FFL.
So you're in favor of strengthening the current law and shrinking that for someone who has actually beaten his wife. You want that person to now be able to have to turn over their guns within 24 hours?
No,
is that what you're suggesting?
No, what I'm suggesting.
No, is that what you're supporting?
No,
Would you support that law? Would you support that change to a law?
The reason why it's 2 business days is because it's not practical. If somebody has a collection that's stored in many different places, it could be impossible to do in 24 hours, especially if it's on a weekend when there's no FFLs open. So the 2 business days is a reasonable period of time, and that should be in this bill. That it's 2 business days. It's and somebody gets the opportunity for an expedited hearing. So if they're accused of doing something prior to having to collect up all their firearms and turn them over, they have an opportunity to get in front of a judge and say, "Judge, it's the abuser who's filed this against me. You got the wrong person," and have the judge decide. Right now, the judge is only deciding based on an ex parte, one-sided affidavit.
John, I think it's important to step back a little bit here and remember what we're talking about. We're talking about trying to remove the guns from the situation for a period of 14 days. The way this is supposed to work out is the application is filed, the application is signed, the guns are turned over in 24 hours. 14 days later, there is a full evidentiary hearing in open court where everybody is present, and the judge at that time decides whether a full restraining order should enter or not. And if not, then the bill specifically provides that the person's firearm should be returned immediately.
We're talking with Steve Stavstrom, who's a Democratic state representative, Doug Dubitsky, who's a Republican state representative. We're talking about a few different pieces of legislation having to do with firearms in the state. We're going to turn to another one having to do with permits to carry. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's Connecticut Primary Day, and we're going to try to build a better primary. A lot of people have been complaining about the system. Republicans have been complaining about it. Democrats have been complaining about it. People are showing up to vote, and they feel like, well, their vote in the primary doesn't even matter. We've got some better ideas, or at least some people who maybe have some better ideas, and they'll be joining us tomorrow. You can join the conversation tomorrow on Connecticut Primary Day and get out and vote. Today, Where We Live, we're talking about guns. We've been talking about it on the campaign trail. We've also been talking about it at the state legislature with Steve Stavstrom, who's a Democratic state representative serving Bridgeport. Doug Dubitsky serves a number of towns in the eastern part of the state. He's a Republican state representative. We just talked about a controversial piece of gun legislation. Here's another one. It would require the holder of a gun permit to show it to a law enforcement officer who sees him or her openly carrying a handgun and asks to see the permit. It removes the requirement that the office base this request on the officer's reasonable suspicion of a crime and the need to verify the permit validity or the permittee's identity. By law, a permittee must carry the permit on his or her person when carrying a handgun. So, Steve Stavstrom, talk us through this. Why is this piece of legislation important?
Sure. Well, John, I think this one, to me, is almost as, if not more important than the previous piece of legislation we talked about. And this really is, to me, about protecting our police officers. We have a situation that's going on around the state right now where we have individuals who are walking into stores. We had one in Bridgeport in the Subway restaurant a couple weeks back. We had it here in Hartford in the Walmart. We had it in Trumbull last week, where individuals who are openly carrying firearms are walking into commercial establishments. Justifiably, people get concerned about that. It creates a little bit of a commotion. A police officer walks over and says, "Sir, do you have a permit for that firearm?" And the individual is saying, "I don't have to tell you. I don't have to show you." They're holding up video cameras, trying to videotape the incidents and the like. And so this bill is actually a bill that came out of the Public Safety Committee, not the Judiciary Committee, but under the leadership of Representative Dargan. And the idea is to give police those tools to be able to ask for it.
Here's a clip of Farmington Chief of Police Paul Melanson testifying in support of this bill at a legislative hearing last month.
And I'll give you a scenario that happened in Farmington about 2 years ago. an individual was on a bicycle with an exposed handgun. He was right across the street from a community college, and on the sidewalk was a bank. Obviously, motorists, people going to visit the bank, had called the police department. We responded, and we asked him for his identification, if he had a pistol permit, and those sorts of things. And he refused to identify himself or show a pistol permit. So how is the police officer on the street supposed to determine whether he is a legitimate, vetted permit holder or somebody with maybe ill intent? And is the police officer, once he refuses to show it, then supposed to leave? It puts us in a very precarious situation. And I have to mention, most permit holders will show you their permit.
Representative Dubitsky, it seems like the police chief's making a pretty good case there. What's the problem with the bill?
The problem is we have this little thing called the U.S. Constitution, which prevents police from detaining people and demanding to see ID unless they have a reasonably articulable reason. They have a suspicion that this person has done something wrong. You can't just grab people on the street for no reason and ask them to produce identification if there's no justifiable basis. If you can't say that you have a suspicion that they've been involved in a crime. For the same reason, you can't just go pull over cars randomly and ask people to see their license. You can't stop people on the street and say, are you a sex offender who's registered and is supposed to?
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about guns. What are the laws currently as far as openly carrying guns in Connecticut?
It is perfectly legal. It is a permit to carry firearms is a permit to carry firearms.
And you don't have to have the permit on you?
No, you do, but you can carry it concealed or you can carry it openly. And somebody who's carrying openly is not doing anything that is suspicious of a crime. Simply because you're carrying a firearm is not a reasonably articulable suspicion that somebody's been involved in a crime. And you can't just detain people when they haven't done anything wrong.
But they do have to carry permits with them.
Yes, they do.
Okay. And so that doesn't change in the law. That's the law right now. And so essentially what the bill would do is it would change whether or not police have to actually are allowed to ask for the permit?
Yeah, it changes the standard under which the police can ask for the permit. It removes the reasonable suspicion requirement and basically says in any instance they can. And if you can't produce your permit under current law and under the bill, you'd be liable for a $35 infraction fine.
Okay, so $35 infraction fine. Representative Dubitsky, I guess a question a lot of people have is a lot of Connecticut residents, we just have a couple of minutes left, are rightly fearful of guns, especially in urban areas where they're not used to seeing guns. If you grow up in a rural area, people see guns all the time. I grew up in western Pennsylvania. People used to hunt deer all the time. I'd see guns a lot. A lot of places they don't. And so how do we strike a balance between people's safety, reasonable fears of what's going on in the world and some of the gun violence that we've seen in the world and protecting the rights of gun owners?
Well, there are a lot of things that people are unhappy with. There are a lot of things that people are scared of. There are a lot of people that think that there are a lot of things that people do that are perfectly legal, perfectly legitimate, perfectly safe that people are scared of. That does not mean that we need to start passing laws restricting the constitutional rights of the people who are carrying out that activity. In this instance, you know, there have been Supreme Court cases on things very similar to this. You know, the Terry versus Ohio, the Terry stop. When can police stop you? When can police detain you? When can police demand answers from you? You know, this is already settled. And the fact that there are people who are uncomfortable with the current law, that are uncomfortable with people carrying firearms, I'm sorry, that's the way it is in this state. It is perfectly legal to walk down the street, even past a bank, carrying a firearm, concealed or openly, if you have a permit.
We only have 15 seconds left. Do either of these bills stand any chance of passage during this legislative session?
Yeah, we still have 10 days left. We're gonna be busy over the next week and a half, and I'm hopeful that both get across the finish line.
There's a lot to talk about. Continue the conversation at WNPR.org/where we live. I want to thank Steve Stafstrom and Doug Dubitsky. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
An important conversation, a lot more to talk about. You can continue it once again also on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.